Hey there, wildlife warriors. Get ready for the Conservationist Assembled podcast, where we team up with the planet's mightiest defenders to learn about the diverse species and landscapes that make our world so amazing. Today's episode is all about black hornbills, and we've got a special guest who's an expert on these amazing birds. Let's give a warm welcome to Tom Clark. Tom, thank you for joining us on the podcast today. How's it going?
Yeah, really well. Really well. How are you? You all good?
Yeah, really well, thank you. I'm happy to hear you're doing good, and I'm thrilled to be discussing hornbills with you, and I can't wait to hear your thoughts. So we'll get going, if that's okay.
Yeah, all good with me.
Fantastic. So I guess first place to start is can you tell us about black hornbills?
Yeah, so black hornbills are kind of like a small to medium-sized Asian hornbill. Get their name obviously because they're predominantly black in their coloration, but the males actually have kind of like a white beak, whatever you want to call it, and then the females actually have a black one. So they're one of a few hornbill species which are actually sexually dimorphic, so quite unique. Some people might look at them and think they're boring, but I think they're really interesting, so they're a cool animal to work with.
Fantastic. And kind of whereabouts are they found?
Yeah, so I mean, way back when they were initially actually called the Malayan black hornbill. So they are from sort of like Asian region, Southeast Asia throughout there, but they are found in more places than obviously just Malaysia. So that's why they kind of got reclassified as just black hornbill now. They are found in a few different areas, which is obviously a good thing. Being more of them widespread is definitely a good thing for the species.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's quite recent that we've kind of discovered that they don't just exist in Malaysia.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been working with them for in a place with hornbills or black hornbills for 15 years, 16 years now. So when I first started, they were Malayan blacks, and it's literally probably only in the last 7 or 8 years, I would say, hazard a guess, that they were, yeah, reclassified as such as black hornbill.
Oh, that's incredible. And it's kind of good to know that can happen. So what are the classifications for black hornbills and their population trend, despite maybe them being found in more places?
Yeah, so there's actually not that much really known of black hornbills out in the wild. They're a bit of a hard species for people to kind of find and track and trace, despite obviously finding them in other areas and stuff now. But currently on they're actually classified as vulnerable with a declining population, so which obviously is not great, but that is kind of a common thing for a lot of the species of animals from the area that these guys are found. So yeah, not great, but still definitely things that are being done and can be done to help the species as well as many others that live in that area.
Fantastic. And well, yeah, we'll get into those things, I'm sure, as there's lots to discuss. So where are the threats to black hornbills coming from?
Yeah, so the kind of biggest threats really is deforestation and loss of habitat. That's kind of like one of the biggest threats facing them. Hornbills, maybe not specifically black hornbills, but other types of Asian hornbills in that area have in the past also been kind of hunted for their beaks. Mainly, mostly for ornamental reasons. And then, yeah, at times I believe they were also used for traditional medicines of some kind as well. But mostly ornamental. I know with the helmeted hornbill, if you actually had one of those beaks, it was seen as a sign of wealth and stuff like that. So that used to be quite a big problem, but something that is improving with more education being provided to the local people where these hornbills are found through numerous different conservation charities. So yeah, biggest threats, deforestation is still kind of that one, but and then yeah, hunting is another one.
That leads nicely into our next point then. You mentioned the conservation charities that are providing these levels of education, and what are those in situ conservation charities that we should be aware of?
Yeah, so one that we support is Hutan. Hutan don't just really specialize in hornbills, they specialize in the whole area that these hornbills are found. Their biggest specialities are actually orangutans and elephants, but they also work to help with hornbills as well. And there is like a little sub charity from that called Gaia, who they work with. And essentially what they try to do to help hornbills is they actually put up artificial nest boxes. So hornbills, as we'll find out, and I'm sure many people know, they nest within trees, hollowed out trees from other animals such as bears and other animals like that. And obviously as trees get cut down, there's less places for these animals to be able to do that. So they'll actually, yeah, put artificial nest boxes like really high up in the air, that hornbills can use. And I've actually, to kind of link it back to kind of my personal thing with working in a zoo, I've actually trialed a lot of these nest boxes in zoos first to make sure that they work and that they're not going to rot and they're not going to cause more damage to the environment than actually help. But yeah, Hutan, they've put up several of these now, and they've actually found four different species of hornbill actually nesting in them. They haven't seen any black hornbills yet, but they've seen others, and it's all in the same areas. But yeah, interestingly, although there's lots of hornbills living in those areas, they'll have ones which tend to nest like on the edges of the forest, and ones that will nest much, much deeper in the forest as well. So yeah, quite a bit of a job for the people that have to trek out into the woods to try and hoist these massive nest boxes up into the trees. I know someone who went to do it, and he said it was one of the hardest jobs he's ever done in his life. But yeah, they're a really, really cool charity, because yeah, it's not just the physical things like that as well. They do a lot of education with the local people, and try to teach the locals that working with the animals can be as profitable for them as actually, you know, the hunting and the killing and the deforestation and the everything like that as well. So that equally, if not more so, plays a more important role than the putting nest boxes up and stuff as well.
That's very cool. I didn't know that about the nest boxes and them being trialled in zoos prior to them being rolled out in the wild. Because that's certainly kind of when you think about how zoos support these conservation charities, it's not necessarily the way that you think zoos would support.
100%. Yeah, you know, the what most people think is donate money, and obviously that is a really important thing. But with so many conservation and research that's been done out in situ, you know, a lot of the time is trialed and tested ex situ in zoos first. So that can play a really, really important role, as well as obviously the financial side of things as well.
So, are there then any other actions that zoos are taking to help conserve black hornbills?
Yeah, so obviously ex situ breeding programs are really important, as well as, you know, education to the general public as well that aren't living in those areas. So breeding programs are obviously really, really important. I'm part of the Black Hornbill Species Committee that kind of meets and helps kind of decide what the next stages are for black hornbills, which is a little bit tricky in Europe for or in EASA, I should say, for a few reasons. One of the biggest ones being Brexit is being a bit of a problem. There's obviously quite a few black hornbills in UK zoos that we can't move to European collections at the moment because there are lots of issues with microchips and paperwork and all things along the lines of that, which is just making it really, really difficult. But the other difficulty is that there's not that many of them either. So in European zoos, as part of the breeding program, I believe the last count up was around 24
Wow.
individuals across the whole of European zoos, which obviously is not a lot. Now we do know there are more in captivity in zoos that just aren't part of the breeding program. So a lot of work needs to be done into researching where they came from, who has them, do people want to be part of the breeding program as well. So there is it's not all doom and gloom. And obviously there's been quite a few successful breedings at my collection, Paradise Wildlife Park, Hertfordshire Zoo now, as well as Paignton has bred them in years gone by, and I believe Drayton Manor has bred them, as well as Birdworld, although I think Birdworld are not actually part of the breeding program, which is one of the collections we're trying to get on board with a breeding program, which would be amazing.
Yeah, it would be amazing. And so aside from kind of collating and trying to collaborate all of these hopefully a breeding population, what are some of the other roles of the Hornbill Species Committee?
Yeah, so mostly like yeah, helping the stud bookkeeper like make decisions on where birds might need to go. But we're also kind of involved in, you know, the management of species, what's best practices for looking after the species in captivity, and doing that. I mean, the best practice guidelines for hornbills currently for EASA actually date back to 2001 as their last kind of like publishing and editing. I wasn't even working in zoos when that was done, and I've been working in zoos for a while. So that obviously needs a bit of updating, and there's still loads of relevant information in there. In fact, I pretty much got most of my information of, you know, breeding and things like that from that book. So it's still really, really relevant, and that's obviously helped us to be able to breed the black hornbills successfully here. But yeah, it definitely needs updating, and that's something we're all kind of working towards. But it's a process. It takes time. We're all, you know, working a full-time job as well as trying to commit to that as well. So.
And what kind of background of members? Is there like a range of background of members of the species committee, or are you all zookeepers, or is there like a
So generally zookeepers, we do have some vets on there as well, but the range of zookeepers is quite varied as well. So when I first started on it, I was deputy head of the bird section here, and when I went into my first meeting, I was in there with a load of curators and another like sort of section lead, and I was like, oh God, this feels a bit daunting. But there is other keepers that aren't section leaders and stuff like that on it as well. So yeah, so it's quite varied. They generally meet in person at the EASA conference once a year, and then we just have like the odd email exchange and sometimes a Zoom meeting, or insert other you know, meeting platform online in there,
Sure.
Teams and whatnot. But yeah, so it's not all the time. It's very much like a we have this situation we need to chat about. Can you meet here, or shall we just do it over email, get it sorted as quick as we can? So
And what would you say that level of networking's done for your career?
that's a very good question. But in the sense of, I think it's actually made me realize that I'm more knowledgeable than I thought I was initially. But kind of, you know, made me realize that, you know, there is a step ladder to the top. There is a way working to get higher and stuff. And that actually, even your curators and everything like that there's normal people and that were doing what you know, younger keepers were doing at one point, and we're all kind of, you know, aiming for the same thing. So obviously made me, when asking for advice on things that are hornbills, made that so much easier, because you know, people that have been working with them for 30, 40, 50 years in some cases, that you know is really important. But it's also made me an approachable person for lots of other people within the industry as well. They know that I'm on the committee, and if they've got any questions, they know they can come and ask me, and I'm always more than happy to, you know, help people with any questions, whatever it is. It point them in the right direction. Tell them that it's a terrible idea, tell them it's a great idea, tell them I have absolutely no if it's I don't know if it's a good idea, try it, see what happens, you know. Or just being that like person who can just kind of go, yeah, that I'd give it a go, you know, I don't see anything bad that can happen with that. So I'm very keen for people, you know, to trial things and learn from things, as long as it's obviously safe for the animals to do so.
Zookeeping
Yeah,
is so network focused at the moment, isn't it?
100%. Like, I mean, I think back to when I very first started, and the idea of talking to someone from another zoo was just like blasphemy. Like, can't do that. Like, oh, they're scary. Oh no, they work there. You can't speak to them. They're way better than us. And I just that's just not the case. Like, you know, there's some super knowledgeable people working in the smallest collections, and they'll have the best, you know, knowledge for the situation that you need. And I feel like everyone is so much more willing to give their help and advice on things than they ever used to be, and that is definitely something we need to tap into a lot more. Be that going to conferences, be that email exchanges, be that podcasts like this, you know, whatever it is, it's definitely a super important thing to ensure that we're doing the best for the animals that we're working
Bringing
with.
it back to hornbills, how can everybody get involved with hornbill conservation, even if they're not directly involved with them?
I guess that's a good question, really. Again, if you're lucky to have a bit of spare change, then donating to these charities or visiting zoos that have these animals plays a big part as well. And just again, like hornbills are for me like a really important species for whole ecosystems. They eat lots of fruit, and they are one of the biggest dispersers of seeds for fruits in the rainforest. So without hornbills going around, pooing everywhere as they do and throwing food everywhere as they do, you wouldn't have half as many like fruit-bearing trees that then feed your sun bears and feed all your orangutans and feed all your other animals. So, hornbills are quite key for the survival of many, many species in that rainforest. So even just like helping to try and improve the areas that they live in. If you're not working directly with hornbills, if you're working with orangutans, you will probably in turn end up helping hornbills. But yeah, as for people, not within zoos or even in with zoos, just visiting zoos that have these species, and you can see on their websites what conservation strategies they support, and therefore you can go to those knowing that you're going to be supporting those charities in some way, shape, or form.
What was one fact about black hornbills that when you first started working with them, or when you first heard it, or kind of experienced it, that you were like, oh, yeah, okay, these are a cool animal, I really appreciate them?
I think the noise that they make is incredible. Like for, it's such a weird noise that you wouldn't expect to come from a bird. It does sound quite prehistoric, but then when you look at them, they also look quite prehistoric, and it's no, it's no wonder that dinosaurs are very close relatives of birds, and specifically hornbills. So, but I mean, the fact that I think really blew my mind, and then experiencing that, was how long the females nest in their nests, and the fact that when people say, oh yeah, they go into a tree and they like seal it all up with mud and leave a tiny little hole that the male passes food through, you're like, oh, okay. And then guess what? They spend 3 months in that box. You're like, oh sure, right. And then yeah, when it actually happens at your collection, and you're like, God, I'm not going to see that bird for 3 months now, apart from on the cameras that we were lucky enough to have on the nest boxes and stuff. So yeah, it's a long time to spend in there, and seeing how well the male does with collecting food and taking it to the female and the babies, and yeah, it's really, really impressive to spend that long in such a tiny area for three months, not only looking after yourself but looking after your chicks, and then coming out looking beautiful as ever because they bolt whilst they're in there as well. And then you go in the box and you're thinking, for the life of me, this is going to smell disgusting, and it's pristine because they poo out of the tiny hole as
Oh,
well. And
wow.
yeah, like it's one of the funniest things ever was where we had positioned our nest box. We didn't think they were going to nest in this one, but they did. It was out on view to the public. We had a few that were hidden, but they went in the one that was on view, and the box faced towards where the public view from. And I remember like a bunch of people being up looking in, and just this bum appearing at the hole that everyone could see, and just this poo projectile flying out from the hole. It is pretty funny. But yeah, there's so many things about hornbills, but knowing that is and then experiencing it is pretty epic to know that they can spend basically like one quarter of the year in this tiny nest box. Crazy.
I'm sure that definitely evokes quite an emotional reaction to seeing that hornbill presenting
Yeah,
to.
like people looking in and they're like, what's that? And then yeah, just this poo comes flying out. It's pretty hilarious. Kids find it funny as anything, but yeah, it's pretty comical to witness.
And do you care to try and do your best hornbill impression?
Oh God, why does everyone do this to me? Like, literally on 1, 2, 3, and oh, I feel like I'm plugging the show now, but on that, every time I do a scene with Cameron, he's like, oh, so what noise does a kookaburra make? Oh, what a noise does a penguin make? And I ended up doing all these noises. But I mean, it's a really I'm building myself up to it. I'm like,
You
no,
really
I'm
are.
not gonna do it, and then I'll try and do it, and I'm gonna deafen everyone. But it's I have no idea if I can do this noise, so I'm gonna give it a go, and it's probably gonna sound terrible, but it's like a it's like a It doesn't sound too much like that, but it's similar to that, and it's very, very loud. And it can be heard really, really far away, because obviously the whole point of their big horns, sorry, on top of their bills, is to help project that volume as well. So it's not just yeah,
We'll have to
it
see
doesn't
if we
sound like
can
that at all.
find
That
a
was,
black hornbill localization and do a comparison
do a
of
comparison, yeah, and
palm
you'll
or
see how,
hornbill. That'll be the
how
new
terrible
segment.
it was.
I feel like there's a reason why they keep asking you to make these noises as
Yeah,
well.
I generally do a good job, but hornbill is not one I've ever tried before. So cheers for that, Johnny. Really
You're
appreciate
welcome.
that.
Well, the podcast is here to enable. Tell us about yourself. Where did you start? How did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, so I guess I'm one of those people that you could say is institutionalized, because I started at Paradise. I could say now, actually, I started at Paradise Wildlife Park, and now I work at Hertfordshire Zoo, but it is the same collection. So yeah, I like most people probably that's getting to this industry, sorry, I am work experience first. I was never supposed to do my work experience at the zoo. I was actually meant to do my work experience at a physiotherapy center, because I was, always about sport. The physiotherapy center went into administration about 2 weeks before I needed to do work experience, and just happened to stumble across the fact that Paradise were taking work experience at the time. Yeah, did that at the age of 15. Really enjoyed it. Volunteered pretty much every Saturday from that day forward, and when I was 17, I think it was, I then got a summer job, where I was not only working with the animals and helping with the shows and the tours and experiences, but also if I was needed to dress up as a costume character, then I would dress up as a costume character, park cars, I'd help park cars. And then I think by the end of the summer, they just forgot that I was still employed. And yeah, one thing led to another, lots of courses, lots of further learning, education whilst working and stuff. And here I am as section leader of birds at Hertfordshire Zoo. I need to get used to saying Hertfordshire Zoo, at Hertfordshire Zoo. So yeah, so I've been in the industry for what, total including volunteering, like 16, 17 years now. So people can work out how old I am from that. But yeah, a long time. But even though I've been at the same collection for all that time, I would definitely say I feel like I've worked at three different collections, because the zoo that I worked at when I very, very started here is so different to the zoo it is now. And in a good way. It's massively, massively improved. And yeah,
Amazing.
you asked me a question there, and I've gone on for about 5 minutes about myself, but I
Absolutely.
like talking
No.
about myself, clearly.
Yeah. Can you come on next week? So what I learned from that is thank God the physiotherapy place went into
Yeah,
administration.
what a different life I would probably have. I'd be probably massaging some person's leg rather than flying birds of prey and hornbills and breeding things and experiencing lots of really cool things in nature. So yeah, just a bit different.
Definitely a bit different. And has there been one individual animal or species in your career that you've gained a particular attachment to or a relationship because you, like say, from the beginning, weren't always just a bird keeper?
Yeah. I think there's been different animals at different points in my career. So, early on, I used to work with the hoofstock quite a lot, as well as the primates. Then I kind of had like a little stint on reptiles. And definitely one of my favorites from that were the two monitor lizards we had. We had a boss monitor called Karoo, who was like the friendliest thing in all of the world. And then we had a big white throat monitor called Moses, who was really, really great. I learned a lot from him just in terms of training. He was one of the first animals I kind of like tried doing training with from scratch, and really kind of got me in the training bug, I would say. But then, yeah, as my career's progressed on, obviously, yeah, working with birds, there's been some real characters that I've worked with in terms of birds, from numerous parrot species, Bobby, a salmon crested cockatoo, who I know quite well, and he was hilarious. He was much loved by all the staff whilst he was around. Sadly, no longer with us. But and then another bird that you all know is Maple, the great grey owl. Everyone knows about mine and Maple's affinity with one another. But yeah, she again was an amazing bird. Again, unfortunately, sadly, no longer with us. But she was really, really cool. Great personality, fun to fly and train and do things with. But then, yeah, like I said, there's so many birds that I've worked with and learned things from. I've got so many that I'm still working with today. So, got to give a shout out to Scally, the spotted eagle owl, who has been here longer than most of the zookeepers
Yeah,
have been here. She's
definitely.
34 years old this year, and she's been here her whole life. So, and she's still going strong. So, she is also, yeah, pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah, that was probably mean for me to say one individual animal, but yeah, definitely
I think everyone will
different
always
ones.
have that one animal that they always reflect back on. But yeah, I have being a trainer, and especially free flying birds, you have to build relationships with these animals, and it's impossible to not. So I think, person I used to work with said that their favorite animal is the one that they're working with at that present moment, or doing like the new behavior with. So
Sure.
and I think that definitely rings true.
Yeah, sounds very wise. And would you then say that training's the favourite part of your role?
I don't get me wrong, like breeding the hornbills was always a big achievement, or like a big like target of mine that I wanted to be able to do. Like the zoo had never bred them before, but had held them as a species for a very, very long time. Obviously breeding the African penguins like year on year on year is like fantastic achievements and stuff. But animal training was definitely always my real, like, once I started doing it and I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like you can massively improve your animal's welfare by them choosing to participate in their husbandry, let alone like the free flying and the enrichment aspects of it. And every year that goes by, every month that goes by, you learn more and more and more, and you see your animals achieve more and more and more through their own choices, and own control is the most important thing. And it makes your life easier in your everyday working with them. So yeah, I look back on how I used to do things 15 years ago, even 10, 7 years ago, to how I do them now, and it's just so much better, so much more improved. And I'm sure in another 5, 7 years time, I'll look at things that I'm doing now and go, wow, we're doing it a lot better now than we were
Yeah,
even doing it
what was
then.
I
So
doing?
yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's been a few occasions where I've gone, God, did I really used to do, like, because obviously people don't know that Paradise doesn't use any anklets or jesses on there. They don't do tethering or anything like that with their birds, but we used to. And I used to do that stuff until, myself and Nikki went, surely there's a better way of doing this, and kind of took that plunge into doing it over a good 5, 6, 7 year period, and look back and go, God, I can't believe we ever used to do that. So but that's just how it was back then, but that's the important thing, is to always look, how can we do things better?
Yeah, and that's definitely, I think, how the majority of collections are looking at it going forward now. There's never the work is never done.
100%. Yeah, I think the one of the most dangerous phrases is, we've always done it that way. That's how we've always done it, and that's such a bad phrase. In some terms, yeah, okay, you can go, okay, we've always done it that way. That's the best way. Well, we've tried a new way, didn't work. But I think if you just write things off because you've always done it that way, then you're doing a disservice to the animals that you're working with.
Breeding successes, training successes. What are some of your proudest achievements to date? Yeah, you've mentioned the hornbills and the penguins. Would you say they're your proudest achievements, or is there something else that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if like just springing to mind, then yeah, breeding the black hornbills is definitely one of my proudest achievements. But to be honest, I think one of the things that I get most proud of, and I don't really think about it at the time, but is when you see like your junior staff like doing what you've trained them to do. Like and not just doing it well, but competently, and being able to do it without you, and not only that, but also trying to improve it themselves, and that is, I never would have associated myself with a person who enjoyed training people as well as training animals. I was, yeah, but that definitely, like, seeing the improvements in people and stuff is definitely a good achievement, because it makes you comfortable that when you're not here, you know that they're going to make sensible choices, sensible decisions, but not only make sensible choices, but have their reasons for that as well. I've all, my mantra with my staff has always been, you will need to make decisions when I'm not here without me, as long as you have a reason why you've done that. It may not be the perfect reason why, but what I don't want you doing is just doing something but not knowing why you're doing that, or having a reason for it. Yeah, I think that's definitely an achievement. And just, yeah, all the training with the animals, you know, letting a bird out of its aviary every single day and it going flying around doing its natural thing and then bringing itself back. That's always I think that's a daily achievement
Yeah, definitely.
for that. So yeah.
Pat yourself on the back
Yeah.
there. So then, knowing what you know now, what bit of advice would have you given to your younger self, attempting to start a career in conservation?
I don't know if there's anything I necessarily would do differently, because if I was to do things differently, I wouldn't be in the position I am now. So I would, yeah, my first few years working in a zoo, I was a bit of a prankster and a bit of a, you know, like, have a laugh and a joke and you're fun and everything like that. And but again, I don't think there's anything I would change, to be honest with you. Or I wouldn't do things any faster, I wouldn't do things any slower. I've always been a person that, you know, take the opportunity that is presented to you at the time. Don't, you know, it's good to set yourself a target, but if you're just constantly focused on that target, then there's so many other opportunities that you could maybe miss out on the way, because you're just so focused on, I have to achieve this. So yeah, I wouldn't really change much, to be honest, or give myself too much advice.
No, I think that's an incredibly valid and kind of very retrospective answer. So kind of get on
Outside
board with
of
that.
working with animals and conservation, I'll probably give myself a lot of advice on things I
That's
did, but within this, I think I think I'm okay.
a whole different podcast, and we'll
Yeah.
maybe get onto that one in the future. Okay, so I think that has given us a kind of a good insight into to the mindset of being a zookeeper, and what stuff goes on behind the doors that we don't necessarily discuss all that often. So we're going to finish up the podcast with some quick fire questions, just a bit fun,
I
light-hearted.
will do my best to be quick fire as well. I'm sure people have realized that I like to talk a lot, so
Some questions. We'll finish up with some questions. The time spent on them is yet to be determined. So the first off, 1 to 5 dream species that you'd either love to work with or see in the wild.
So most people that know me know that my numero uno number one animal that I'd love to work with at some point is California sea lions. I don't know why. I just love sea lions. I love the idea of mammals swimming in the ocean and stuff. So yeah, California sea lions. I'd love to work with I'd like to work with emperor penguins at some point, or at least go and see them out in Antarctica, as cold as that may be. So yeah, that would be quite a cool thing to see. I'd obviously in the wild like to see probably most species of Asian hornbill as well. So that would be, yeah, quite cool. And then, like, kind of working with, probably from a bird perspective, I'd love to obviously work with a species of vulture, old world vulture specifically, be it hooded or even Egyptians, like the smaller ones, I think are really, really cool. And then, I don't know really. I'm quite open to most species to work with. So,
I
yeah.
see what ticks some boxes for you outside of bird species.
Yeah, aquatic mammals I've always been pretty fascinated by. So.
So then, maybe this would be influenced by sea lions, maybe not. One country or continent that you'd love to call home?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, for all it's, there's a lot of bad about living in England and the UK, but it's quite cool at the same time. I don't know. I've, to be honest, I've always been kind of fascinated by the idea of like New Zealand or even like Southeast Asia, somewhere around there would be, I think, pretty cool. Nice varied species in Southeast Asia as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot to take in. You could dig it at the very least, spend a significant amount of time there, and yeah, still not see a lot,
Yeah, exactly.
or still have lots left to see
Or
more
yeah, have
appropriately.
lots left to see. Yeah, 100%.
And if there was one species from around the world that could be native to the UK, then without any negative effects on the ecosystem, because we've got to be little and we, yeah, playing God clearly doesn't work a lot of the time, so.
No, does it not? I
Yeah. What species would you love to see in the UK?
mean, I don't live anywhere near the ocean or the sea or whatever you want to call it, but I'd love like just to look out the door and there'd be a sea lion just walking along. I don't know if you've seen like there's
Neil.
Neil,
Yeah,
yeah. Just
I've
how amazing would that be?
Yeah.
Just having this giant like marine mammal just knocking your letterbox over. That would be
Yeah.
great.
Lying on a traffic cone.
Is it negative to the environment if it annoys people? Probably not,
No,
right?
yeah. I suppose we probably deserve that, don't we? if you could be an animal, would it be Neil?
Yeah, I'd be Neil. Yeah, 100%. That's just the life, isn't it? It's gonna be my answer to the rest of the questions now.
Just Neil.
Neil the
Neil,
seal.
Neil, Neil's life. when you're not working, I'd keep busy.
I'd knock over people's let no
Yeah, I was going to say, I committed you were going to be to this.
I no so I have a few hobbies. I'm in a marching band, lead a marching band, help teach marching band people to be a marching band basically and stuff like that, and we go around the world and play music and performing competitions, and a few years ago we was the world champions, so not too bad at it either. So yeah, that's probably my main kind of thing outside of work. And then the other thing is I now have a lovely 4-month-year-old daughter that I get to spend time with as well, so that's a whole new element to my life, which is stressful but fun.
Very well, yep, huge congratulations on that, and having the daughter too. No, I'm joking. huge congratulations on having the daughter, and yeah, followed your marching band work for a long time. It's certainly quite a unique hobby. It's not something that you hear a lot of people saying that they
It's
do.
always interesting when you say to people, "Oh, I'm in a band," and they go, "What do you play?" And I go, "Oh, I spin a stick and stand at the front." So, yeah.
But it did get you to march around Disneyland Paris, didn't you? Which is
Got to
pretty
do
cool.
lots of things because of that band, so it's great. Yeah.
Yeah, fair. Do you have any inspirations or kind of who inspires you within conservation?
It's a difficult one to say really, because I'm probably most inspired by the people I know. Obvious ones that people will always say is like David Attenborough and stuff like that. And don't get me wrong, I love watching his documentaries and everything like that, but I wouldn't say I was ever necessarily like inspired by that. But I have been inspired by people that work in the industry and I've worked with specifically. Nicky Plaskett was a big inspiration for me of animal training. Steve Martin as well, from the animal training perspective. But yeah, I just get inspired by hearing what people have done, and that can change on a day to day. You go to a conference and you see someone who you've never even heard of and they do something really cool and you're like, wow, that's amazing. That's really, really cool. So yeah.
That's given us David Attenborough impression.
No.
too much. I've ruined it. Okay.
I there's people you're allowed to butcher, but I don't think you can butcher
You'd
it. Oh, that
be
sounds weird. You
cancelled.
can't butcher David Attenborough. That's yeah, definitely you can't
Yeah, fair enough. Get cancelled and
do that.
that's that. Biggest hurdle of your career.
Yeah.
So, what is last one then? What is one thing that you think our listeners should take away from today's episode?
That's a good, very good question. That one, black hornbills are amazing and are not boring just because they're a medium-sized blackbird. Also, just delving into the taboo subjects and stuff, and that it's okay to not be okay, and it's okay, and especially okay to talk to people when you're not okay with these things, and that unfortunately, yeah, working with animals, bad things do happen, but lots of good things happen as well. So, try, be true to yourself. be, you know, committed to what you're doing. And no matter what you're doing, you can make a difference to animals and wild. You don't have to be one of these people climbing up in the trees and putting the nest boxes in. You can do things closer to home and still make a massive difference to animals out in the wild as well.
Fantastic. Very insightful. And yeah, I think, lots to take away from this episode. And I think something that everyone, there's something for everyone, to take
Yeah.
away from it. So Tom, a massive shout out to you. Thank you for appearing on the podcast and sharing your knowledge and your experience with us. And certainly obviously with it, with regards to black hornbills, but also your unwavering dedication to, providing top-notch welfare and conservation to these animals, whilst enlightening all of us as to how we can get involved and stay positive at the same time. So we wish you all the best for the rest of your career. We'll be sure to keep in touch with or keep up to date with what you're doing, and you never know, hopefully we'll have you back on the podcast in the
Yeah,
future.
definitely. I'd love to come back, and you know, all the success to you with the podcast, and you know, anyone that's listening, good luck with everything you're doing as well. And yeah, if you see me, hear me, do anything at a conference, wherever you are, say hello. I'm friendly, most of the time. So yeah, just come and say hello, and yeah, let's have a chat.
Well, that's all from the Conservation Assembled podcast this week. Thanks a million for tuning in. Follow the podcast on Instagram and Facebook at Conservation Assembled Pod to stay connected to the latest updates. And hey, if you found this episode as amazing as I did, be sure to like, share and leave a 5-star review. This helps us spread the word and bring you more conservation heroes with their fascinating stories. Thank you so much, and I'll catch you all next time.